DW Africa Link.
Northern Nigeria has been rocked, villages emptied, farms abandoned, families torn apart and displaced by floods, banditry and communal clashes. Over 2.6 million people are living in displacement across the region, forced from their homes, surviving on the margins. Schools shattered, healthcare unavailable, food insecure, dreams deferred. Amid this crisis, the Nigerian government's resettlement plan rose amid cautious hope. To rebuild communities, restore agriculture, reopen schools, and bring back normalcy. But now, renewed attacks are threatening to undo those fragile gains.
We migrated here about 10 years ago. There is still no peace. We want to return to our homes, but for those who have gone back, we often hear that there is still insecurity here and there these days. It would be better for us to stay in one place. But ideally, we would like the government to support our businesses. Without farming, some people have nothing to do. Even with farming, going to faraway farms near the bush can lead to problems. Flooding has destroyed some farmlands, leaving nothing behind in the areas damaged by water.
Actually, the government returned us, but due to security concerns, we came back again. The government should intervene to support us in one way or another, because honestly, we are suffering here. This situation is not just affecting our livelihoods, but also our mental and emotional well-being. The government should come to our aid immediately. I pray that they will.
In this podcast, we ask, are the latest waves of violence and insecurity putting the resettlement plan at risk? What happens when people return? Who pays when protection fails? And can institutions, federal, state, local, and humanitarian pull it all back from the brink? That's what's coming up. Stay tuned. My name is Josephine Mahachi. Welcome to Africa Link, the podcast that connects you to the stories that matter from and on Africa.
Africa Link, every weekday here on DW.
In Borno State, northeast Nigeria, the government has closed all official displacement camps, relocating over 150,000 people under its resettlement program. The goal, to repopulate rural areas and signal progress against insurgency. But for many families, leaving the camps has meant new risks, renewed militant attacks, food shortages, and a lack of schools and clinics. Now, what was meant as a step toward recovery has, in many cases, deepened insecurity. Joining me for this episode is Dengiefa Angalapu of the Center for Democracy and Development on the dangers of the strategy. And from Abuja, DW's correspondent Abiodun Jamiu shares the lived realities of resettled families. I'll just start with you, Abiodun, if you can just give us a brief overview of exactly what is happening for us to have this discussion today.
Okay, thank you, Josie. Because of the attacks in the north, the northeast, the Borno State government has a model where they plan to resettle the IDPs, internally displaced persons, back to community where there have been no recorded attacks in those area. And this is, according to the governor, to project a semblance of normalcy, that the state is getting back to normalcy, and the fact that to win communities or IDPs off dependence and aid and build the resilience of the Borno people that they are known to be. So basically, that's actually what the resettlement plan has been about. They resettle them IDPs in displacement camps to new areas that are safe, and then shut down IDP camp in the main capital. But recently, we have seen renewed attacks, the resurgence of Boko Haram and an ISWAP and other group in the northeast, which means people in these resettled communities are no longer safe. There are no security for them. And we have seen some of them fleeing back to the capital city Maiduguri for survival and safety.
If you can just expand a bit on these renewed attacks, Abiodun, before I turn to Denge.
Okay, for context, Boko Haram and ISWAP had been the major groups in the northeast, you know, carrying out attacks with the hope of instituting an Islamic caliphate in the northeast. And it started way back as 2009. So we had major attacks in the region and top part to North Central Nigeria, where they had, over the years, there was some kind of normalcy where the Nigerian government recorded some, you know, success regarding, you know, stemming the tide of some of the violence we recorded in those regions. But recently, as far back as January, early this year, we have ISWAP, you know, conducting, even using drones to carry out attacks, you know, carrying out series of attacks on military formations. And recently, we also have attacks on you know, civilian populations like that. So it has been a huge concern for the IDPs. They were resettled to the communities. Now that these attacks are resurging, they're coming back in full force. And because of the fact that our military is stretched since, we have other resources in the northeast already been deployed to other parts of the country where there are conflicts. So it provides a window of opportunity for jihadists to actually stage a comeback. And it's been a very big issue trying to contain the situation now.
Right. Now, Denge, to come to you, the government presents camp closures as a way to, in quotes, reclaim depopulated rural areas. From a security perspective, you know, how realistic is this strategy and what does it mean really for the fight against insurgency?
Yeah, thank you so much. So for context, I think that we need to understand, I mean, Jamiu has done a very good job by taking us history lane to understand, you know, some of the challenges that the Borno State has faced and also the residents have faced over time. But for context, it is good to understand the perspective of the government and why probably they want them to want the IDPs to go back to these resettlement camps. And this conflict has lasted for like 15, 16 years now, and that's quite a long time. It's a long time for people to live in an IDP camp, and you might want to ask, you know, how long will this last? So you can understand from the perspective of the government to say, okay, I think it is time for us to resettle them. It is time for them to live some kind of normal life. It is time to give dignity back to these people. It is time for them to go back to their farms and all of that. I think this is the thinking that, you know, that went through the resettlement process. However, you know, it is quite sad that recently we've had a resurgence of the Boko Haram, whether ISWAP or JAS. You know, so that has actually made it very complicated. Remember, we had a lull in violence where there was some sort of, you know, decline in violent attacks and incidences, and it was almost celebrated. You know, in fact, in 2017-16, thereabout, you know, the former president Muhammadu Buhari came to say Boko Haram has been technically defeated. I mean, this is to tell you that, you know, after the 2015 and 2014 attacks, there was some kind of lull in violence. So you can see the thinking that went through the idea that probably, you know, now that we've achieved a lot of these kind of successes, we need to begin to resettle communities. Now, are there advantages to that? Yes, there are advantages, because when local communities are resettled, they reclaim places where we call ungoverned spaces. You know, these were communities of people, these were farmlands of people. So they reclaim these spaces. What happens also is that we now have human intelligence there. So they're able to give the government, you know, report about some unknown movements or suspicious movements. So they become early warning platforms once they are resettled in those places. But if nobody is there, it is difficult for the government to get information. Now, why is it problematic? It becomes problematic when you tell people to resettle and then you don't have the capacity to protect them. Because once they resettle, they now rely on your capacity to protect them, because it is taken for granted that they are now in a safe place and the military can protect them. So I think that beyond the Borno State government, it is a failure of the security architecture generally that needs to be blamed for the system. It is not just the system, it is not just a resettlement policy, but a failure of the security agencies to protect them. Because, I mean, if they can attack them in a resettled place, really, it also means that even the IDP camps are probably not safe. So if we are creating a safe spaces for them to go and resettle them, I mean, no matter how long the conflict takes anyway, we are going to get to a place where we are going to talk about resettlement. But how and when is actually the challenge in this matter.
Right. How and when. But then, Tengef, also the other thing people would want to know is what risks exactly do these resettled families face when they are like moved back to areas where, you know, these insurgent groups are still active?
I think that the challenge is really the fact that we've resettled people and we've not given them adequate protection, adequate security. So what it now means is that we are bringing them back to the rule of the bandits, the rule of the terrorists, the rule of the Boko Haram. That's what it actually means. Because if you take them to a particular community and you don't effectively govern them, there are people that will govern them. And unfortunately, these people that will govern them are the terrorists. So let's just say you resettle them, and then the terrorists come back to say, well, you are now back to us, so you have to pay taxes, you know, before you can access your farm, or you even have to pay taxes, or you have to subject yourself to, you know, to our conflict resolution processes or to our rule, really. So it is the fact that I think the basic challenge is that we resettled people without giving them adequate security or governance model.
So sorry, before I attend to you, Abiodun, just with you still, Dengi, do you think then the Nigerian government is finding it hard to really deal with this insecurity issues? Like they have to be fighting on the other side and also in ensuring that the resettled people have security. Do you feel like there's a gap there that now maybe NGOs or maybe just the international community should also intervene?
Yes, there are actually gaps, you know, that international agencies, NGOs can actually come into plug. This requires a whole of society approach. That means that, you know, the communities, NGOs, international partners need to come on board. So early warning signals, for example, when these communities have been settled, you know, we expect, for example, by now, even before these attacks that happened, we expect that international NGOs or even NGOs locally should have gone to this community to say, what are the threat levels? What have you been seeing? We shouldn't have waited for these attacks to really happen before we know that these communities are vulnerable. And if you go to these communities and ask them, they probably will tell you that long before even these major attacks on these resettlement centers happened, they have been vulnerable. Probably they've been seeing signs, they've been seeing threats and all of that, that probably must have been ignored. So we need to put our hands together to see that once a policy has been put in place, we have to investigate the viability of this policy before an attack so that we don't start, you know, beating a dead horse or start, you know, taking medicine after death. So I think it's very important. Put in early warning signals and ensure that once the early warning signal does not lead to any response, you know, the international agencies are able to shout about it to say, well, the communities are complaining that they are seeing strange faces up and down, but yet early response system is not working as such. So I think it's very, very important that we take a whole of society approach. Unfortunately, I do not know, you know, how this resettlement plan was broadly deliberated and accepted by all before it was implemented.
Right, right. Now, Biodun, turning to you as our eyes and ears on the ground, we know that you've been following this government's camp closure program closely, and you've even visited some of these resettlement sites. What exactly did you see? You know, families were promised security and basic services in their new communities. Is that reality? Did they get everything that they were promised? And we know that even some of these displaced people are describing it as a second displacement. Just to understand what exactly that means.
The reality on the ground is actually wide and very different from what was promised and the reality on the ground. What they mean by second displacement, they're talking about the feeling of being uprooted over and over again. You know, in the first instance, they were displaced from their communities by Boko Haram, ISWAP, and JAS, and then they flee to the capital, living in camps for as many years. Now, they also felt like, okay, they were being displaced again by the state government, by states, because some of them were not consulted even before they were, you know, resettled back to some communities. They are now like settlers, because this land, these communities belong to some people. So some of them do not even have access to lands, to farm, because the locals there will not give them that. So most of the times, they also have to go deep into the forest to get firewood to work on. At the end of the day, while going around to get this, they fell into the trap of terrorists and jihadists. And some of them are ransomed in such a way that when they are kidnapped, they ask for a huge, you know, sum of money as ransom. And when they are unable to provide this, they are killed. So these are some of the concerns that some of them have when they said, when they describe it as you know, as second distillery. And apart from that, there is also a concern about their services in these communities, because some of them do not even have access to potable waters, do not have access to, you know, proper health care, because these are rural communities that are far off from city center, from semi-urban area, and something like that. For instance, the Daru Jamal attack that happened recently happened along the border with Cameroon, far off from the city center, far off from even semi-rural area, that they can get, you know, distress. The authorities can actually respond to distress call. So these are examples of some of the things that we experience when they go deep into, when we go into these communities to look at some of. In fact, we spoke with returnees in Maiduguri, where some of them are currently staying. Some people that flee from some of these resettled communities and currently in Maiduguri, they also, you know, made the same concern about the fact that there are no services, there are no protections for them in this area.
All right. Now, Dingy, if maybe just also to talk about suggestions, you know, to try and weaken these groups, the ISWAP, and counter-insurgency terms. Do you think repopulating rural areas actually can work in weakening these groups in the country, or it might actually end up strengthening them?
Very interesting question, and I think that it is one that does not really have a very straightforward answer. But I can actually, I will categorically say that repopulation can actually weaken armed groups, you know, because you are taking back the land, you're taking back the space, you're taking back the intelligence, you're taking back the agency, you know, from the armed groups and all of that. But repopulation only weakens a armed group only when the state can protect the people. So if the state cannot protect the people, repopulation in that place is actually leading them into the hands of the armed group. It's like we have escaped from them and they're driving us back into their hands. So again, I would say repopulation weakens an armed group, yes. Because you're taking back the land, you're taking back the agency, you're taking back the intelligence, you're taking back the space. But then if it does not guarantee adequate protection for the people day and night, for them to carry on their businesses, you're actually driving them back into a situation that they ran away from. So I think that we need to understand that before we take on or we implement some strategies.
And then human rights groups also warn this policy actually ignores international standards on safe returns. Remember earlier I asked the gap that maybe the non-governmental organizations, international community can also fill. Dengi, how does this then tension between security goals and humanitarian principles play out in practice? And do you foresee government acting even on this to say, you know what, we need to do something about our people?
Yes. I mean, I can understand from the aspect of the Borno State government, it is frustrating to have maintained IDP camps for over, you know, for like 16, 15 years and all of the regimented arrangements in those camps. But I would categorically say that the international human rights bodies are actually right. You know, closing camp shouldn't be the goal. Safe and dignified living is the goal. So we have to wait till the conditions are right before returns, you know, should actually go ahead. So we shouldn't return when the conditions are not actually right. So where conditions are not right, we should pause and then strengthen the conditions before we go back. I am not sure that any NGO or any international government agency really would say, oh, we shouldn't resettle. But the timing and then how that is done, the strategy is very, very, very important. So overall, it is the condition and not the dates that drive decisions. So you have to publish the criteria, you have to verify them independently before you move on to ensure, in fact, do a very good intelligence security mapping on those places. If it is possible, set up security architecture around all of those communities and ensure that the communities are even close to one another. If you don't have the security that would move very far immediately to respond, let them be close to one another so that you can protect them So those communities now become a very big IDP camp, guided by security agencies before you can deploy them or tell them to move to those communities, because we cannot be driving our population back into the hands of the terrorist group that they are running away from.
Now, Biodun, both are mentioning obviously these militant attacks resurfacing in Borno. That's what we are talking about, just to also remind our listeners. But I've seen other states in Nigeria coming up with their own strategies to protect themselves, you know, in neighborhood watches, their own security groups. Do you see that happening in Borno State? Do you people feel unsafe, obviously, being moved to these places? So my question is, do you see them starting something or coming up with their own solutions to ensure safety and security for themselves?
They tried that over and over again. We've had the Joint Task Force in Borno that actually proved to be quite very helpful working with security, conventional security operatives in the region. Some of them are overwhelmed in the sense that they cannot, there's no apparatus that they can build up that will match to the sophistication of terrorists or jihadists like Boko Haram and ISWAP. So most of them, they are left in the cold. There's nothing they actually can do, most of them. That is why we see some of them, you know, fleeing back to the city, to Maiduguri, to the capital, to actually, you know, ensure their safety. So because they cannot match up with the sophistication of and the brutality of the jihadists like Boko Haram and ISWAP, the kind of consequence that comes with deferring these people is too huge and brutal for them to even say they want to put up a defense, they want to, you know, protect themselves against these people.
And Dengi, Nigeria's military has been stretched thin for years. You know, this insurgency insecurity has been going on now for long, and obviously everybody in the world wishes that there can be a permanent solution in Nigeria. But do you think it has capacity to both fight insurgents and also protect these resettled civilians at the same time?
Yes, so I think that the military can actually do that. And beyond the military, we have different security architectures. We have the police, we have the civil defense corps, we have the DSS, we have different, a lot of architecture that can enhance their values, resources to fight these insurgents. I think that it's a matter of strategy and then culture, really. If you know that your resources are thin, you do not need to spread them wide in a manner that, you know, that is difficult to manage. So we already know we have difficulty with respect to personnel. We already know we have difficulty with respect to technology. So what do you do? Like I said, the resettlement plan is not a problem in itself, really, but it is the protection of the civilians. So you ensure that you bring all of the resettlement places to areas where they are closed. So you have clusters. So for example, if you have two or three clusters, you put the resettled people in those clusters and ensure that all of those clusters are guided very well. So they are adequately protected. So those places now become the safest places for those people to be. So that's why I said those clusters now become the big IDP camp. Of course, I sympathize with the people of Borno and the Borno State government for having maintained IDP camps. It is not easy to have maintained IDP camps for this long. I am not sure that there is a special budget from the federal government to say, oh, this is particularly for IDPs, beyond perhaps support from the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs. So there is no special budget to say this is it, and I can understand the frustration. But then we should not, because of the fact that we just want to say, oh, the conflict has reduced, we want to ensure that, oh, we don't have IDPs anymore, push people back into the front lines of terrorism. So we should ensure that we put them in different clusters and have them guided. Our security is stretched. But if you put them in different clusters, you are able to guide them adequately. But if you put them in different communities, very far and then far from security agencies, far from different checkpoints and all of that, you can be rest assured that, you know, those communities will be very, very vulnerable because, you know, they are far from the response system of security agencies.
Diengiefa Angalapu of the Center for Democracy and Development, and from Abuja, our correspondent Abiodun Jamiu, many thanks for joining us.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
We asked some Nigerians about their sentiments on this development. Take a listen. You've heard from some northerners and they're hoping for a tangible and permanent solution. Now that's it for this edition of Africa Link. Remember, you are not just a listener, but you're a vital part of our community. Your engagement can shape the direction of our discussions. We highly value your insights and encourage you to share your thoughts with us. Remember, you can find all of the Africa Link podcast episodes on Spotify and Apple or wherever you listen to your podcasts from. This episode was co-produced and edited by Isaac Mugabe. My name is Josephine Mahachi. Thanks for listening. Until the next one, it's bye for now.
DW, Made for Minds.